You're listening to Sports Connections with David Smale, the show that brings you a fun and intimate look into connections throughout sports. Now here's your host, David Smale.
Rex Hudler had a 10-year career in the major leagues after a 10-year career in the minor leagues, plus he threw in a year in Japan in the middle of a big league career. He was drafted in the first round of 1978 by the New York Yankees, the selection before Cal Ripken Jr. was taken by the Baltimore Orioles. Hud was an all-around athlete who was named first-team All-American at wide receiver in high school, and he had a letter of intent to play football at Notre Dame. He played like his red hair was on fire, earning the nickname Rex the Wonder Dog, one of the great nicknames in sports. Since retiring as a player, he's worked in the broadcast booth for 20 years after spending 10 years with the Angels. He's in his 10th year as a color analyst for the Kansas City Royals television network. His approach behind the mic is the same as it was on the field, all out, all the time. And he joins us today basically to brighten our day. Hud, welcome to Sports Connections.
Dave, wow. You know, listening to you say that, I'm thinking, man, am I that old? But you know what? I don't feel it. I tell you, I'm so thankful. What a, you know, people sometimes will say, why are you like you are? And I say, why shouldn't I be?
Yeah.
I've never had a real job in my life. I've done everything that I've ever dreamed of doing, and broadcasting wasn't one of them. That was a hand given. That was given to me by God only, and man, he's put me in some really great spots, Dave. I'm so happy to be with you to share.
Well, and we talked about this before we started recording. We're catching you in your car today because your most important role is that of a dad, and because of your career, you haven't been able to watch your kids play sports as often as you like. Today, as we're recording this, you're watching your middle son, William, play baseball at Johnson County Community College, something you don't get to do very often.
Yeah, Dave, I'll tell you what, I wouldn't exchange my career for anything. The only negative about my baseball broadcasting career has been it takes me away from my kids sometimes, you know, during the summer. But you know what, though, that being the only negative, that's pretty good. And my kids, they understand.
Yeah.
They know that I love them. And then in the off season, I pour into them. And so there's no issues there at all. This is a beautiful day today. And like even 19-year-old son acts like he's a 9-year-old boy. Just seeing my dad, he sticks his head out of the dugout and sees my car and sees me in it. And he's happy I'm there.
Yeah.
That's and, you know, really Dave, cool. Dave, that's my legacy. That's my kids are my legacy in my life. However long it's going to be, I don't know, but that's my legacy, and it's not what I did or what I do. So I'm only doing what God commands me to do, and that's to love my family, put my family before just about anything else besides Him.
All right, and you answered my last question, but I'm still going to go in the order that I that I have them for you, other than my last question, which is what is your legacy? So let's start with your athleticism. As a high school senior, you had to decide between pursuing a professional baseball career and playing college football at Notre Dame. What went into that decision?
Wow. Dave, it was a blessing. You know, I really wasn't that good, Dave. It sounds like I was some kind of Dave Winfield phenom. No, I was not. I was just a young kid who had a passion since elementary school on becoming a professional athlete. And, you know, the two classes that I excelled in most in school was recess and PE. Those were my two favorite subjects. And I competed during all of those.
Yeah.
And, you know, I competed not to hurt anybody, but I competed to win. And so that was developed in me. And then, going to high school, I was blessed with tremendous coaches that had great experiences. A high school, college baseball coach taught me, a legend. And my football coach played in the NFL, you know, as a quarterback. So look, I was mentored by some of the greatest. Now I was blessed with some skills. Soccer helped develop my speed, my agility. That's the first sport I ever took up in kindergarten. And then that was the only sport I ever quit, because my senior year in high school, my mom, she said, son, you know, you're good in all three sports, but don't you want to be great in one or two of them? And I said, yeah, Mom, I'd like to do this for a living sometime somewhere. She goes, well, then you need to eliminate a sport and concentrate on two. Three's too much. It's watering you down. And I, again, my mother was my hero. And she gave me some of the greatest advice in my life ever. And so once again, I said, Mom, you're right. So I quit soccer and focused on baseball and football. And look what God did for me. He brought two of the best teams in the world in their sport. The Yankees had just won a World Series in 77. And the Fighting Irish with Joe Montana and Coach Dan Devine just won a national title in 77 as they won the Cotton Bowl. And now it's 78, and I have an opportunity to play for both teams. But you can't do both. At least they didn't back then. So what did I do whenever I had a roadblock, even when I was young? I got on my knees and asked God, what does he want? Where do you want me? And so he made it easy for me by the Yankees. I remember when I came home from school on the draft day in June in 78. And I came home from school like any other day, walked in the door, said, Mom, did anybody call today? She said, yeah, the damn Yankees drafted you. And I said, what? The Yankees? Mom, that's a pretty good organization. They're winners. They won the World Series last year. I said, what'd you tell them? She said, I told them they wasted their pick. Because like most moms, she wanted me to get a degree, and especially from Notre Dame. I'd have been able to work anywhere in the world I wanted to. I said, thanks, Mom. And so the Yankees called a week later, and Al Rosen, who was the vice president of the New York Yankees, a former great third baseman for the Cleveland Indians in his day, and Jack Butterfield, two of the top brass with the George Steinbrenner had, they came out to Fresno, California to sign me. And that's exactly what they were there for. And I found this out later that Mr. Steinbrenner said, whatever he wants, give it to him. I want that kid. So my mom, when they showed up at the door, my mom sent me out to go get my pizza at my pizza place down the road. And I was like, why? And just go, come back in about 45 minutes. Okay. And so I came back. I knocked on my own front door because it was locked. And my mom opened the door and she said, congratulations, son, you're a Yankee.
Oh, wow.
And so, long story short, she didn't want me in the meeting to jump at the first offer. She knew she was going to negotiate. I didn't have an agent because it would have jeopardized my my amateur status. So she negotiated with the New York Yankees and got me into pro baseball at 17 years old. And I went right away. George Steinbrenner wanted to meet me, and he flew me to New York City. And then after New York City to upstate New York to play for Oneonta in the New York Penn League. And wow, my adventure and I exchanged a Notre Dame degree to catch passes from Joe Montana for a worldly degree in baseball. And that's exactly what it was. It was not the beginning that I thought it was going to be. It was tough, Dave, but look, what a blessing. And by me not going to Notre Dame, it really hurt Joe Montana's career, didn't it?
Yeah, he didn't amount to anything, did he? All right. No, you're good at name dropping, and I love it. I think people who don't drop names are missing the mark. So I will just tell you that right from the start. You became friends through the years with Cal Ripken. How often do you bring up the fact that you were selected before him?
You know, we played against each other in A-ball. Then in 1978, right? About 1979 or 1980, 1979 and 80, he was in the Florida State League and playing for Miami, the Miami Orioles. And he only played in A-ball 1 year, and then he went right to the big leagues. He was on their world championship team in 81. So he didn't do hardly any minor leagues. And, you know, lots of times it's where you are, right place, right time.
But, plus, he had a lot of skill, too.
Oh, no doubt. He was a good player. Yeah. He was a good player, but you know, at that age, so was I. I mean, being drafted ahead of him, that was kind of my claim to fame, as it turned out overall. But I didn't talk with him a lot in A-ball. But then once I got to the majors, I got on base, and the only time I talked to Cal was in the game, whenever he got on second or I got on the base, And I would always bring it up. I would say, I would ask the umpire, whoever was listening, I would say, Hey, could you believe I was drafted ahead of Cal Ripken? And so he would walk up and say, yeah, well, you know, you never reached your full potential. You know, he was kind of, it sounded like he was a little bit bitter about that, but as the years went on and I played against him all the time, you know, he was like, HUD, you were better than I was at that particular time. But hey, look, you know, he didn't have to say anything. He had a Hall of Fame career. I rode the pine for nine and was a utility player. So there was no arguing there. But I always had kept it light and had fun. And, you know, and then and it turns out all these years later, I'm with the California Angels in Baltimore for the three games when he broke the record of Lou Gehrig.
Yeah.
For consecutive games. I was playing second base on the field in Camden Yards that night. And the whole series, I started every game in the three-game series. And that was ended up being the highlight of my career.
Yeah.
And I was 0 for 12 during the series. I didn't do anything. But just being in a game of that magnitude was incredible. I really am thankful for the opportunity to have played for so long, to meet so many people, but to be in certain games during my Major League Baseball career that were monumental games and historic games way outweighs whatever I could do. You know, I never made one playoff and my numbers in the game weren't very pretty at all. So look, just the opportunity of playing it for a long time and meeting all these people and going different places was everything that I believed it would be. And so, you know, if you look at my numbers, it doesn't look like I had that great in a career, but you know what, if you ask me, I had a Hall of Fame career and not numbers, but just the fact that I got to meet people and go places. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of the things that I think people really enjoy about listening to you on the air, one of the reasons you've become so popular is your ability to joke about yourself. I remember one of the first conversations you and I had 10 years ago, you were talking about your career and you said that, and I don't know if you made this story up or heard it from somebody else or if it actually happened. It may have actually happened. Every once in a while, one of your stories is true. But you talked about the fact that somebody was heckling you from the stands saying, Hudler, you don't belong in here. What are you doing playing second base? And you said, hey, the manager wrote my name in there. What am I supposed to do? Tell him no?
Oh, yeah, Dave Nook, all those happened. Yeah, all the stories I tell, none of those were made up. Now, fabrication, maybe I might have stretched it a little, but like we all do. But I can tell you, the fans, I always played for the fans. I was taught at an early age to hustle.
Yeah.
And there was only two things that I found out in 21 years of playing baseball that I could control. That was my output, my hustle, and my attitude. So if I controlled those two things and I had any talent at all, I knew I had a chance to play for a long time. And so I always hustled for the paying customer, the fan that paid. I don't care, minor league, major league, the fan that paid deserved everything I got that night. And so I would run in, and you know, sometimes, you know, fans like to have a good time. I'd run in from the field and there was that guy going, yo, Hudler, you blank, you know, whatever. And you know, and sometimes, you know, we're trained to ignore stuff from the fans, you know, just to kind of go. I would stop and look up in the stands and say, hey, I know I suck, but you know, man, he keeps playing me. What am I supposed to do? You know, and the whole whoever heard that, like hundreds of people would laugh and so when I came running back out again, they cheered for me. So,
yeah.
You know, they knew that I got it. And I had so much fun with the fans. You know, I wish I would have been an everyday player, but you know what? There was a reason why I wasn't. Obviously, I would get overexposed if you played me too long. And then, but you know what? I was, I don't want to say I was a cheerleader, but I love to encourage. I like to have fun on the bench. You know, I really enjoyed that too. And so, to me, I just had a happy, happy first career.
Describe yourself as a player. Basically, take a look at current major league players and give us a comp to somebody that you were like.
Oh, I wish I was Whit Merrifield. I was very high strung. I was very enthusiastic. I was passionate. And you throw, and I had really good speed. I'm not bragging, but I had really good speed. I could run. I was above average. And I was an intense player. So I was a football player, basically, in a baseball player's body. And that held me back for a long time. Offensively, when I had the bat in my hand, sometimes I want to punch the pitcher in the mouth. You know, it wasn't like, you know, so I didn't get the game. His job was to get me off balance. I was jumping. I was always jumping. I had a hard time learning how to calm down and how to breathe. I tell my son now, son, if I could go back and do it again, I would have learned how to breathe. And I would learn how to use the power of the breath and calming the muscles so I could react quicker. So I had a hard time with that. I could play anywhere on the diamond. And Joe Torre once, when I played for him for a couple years with the Cardinals, you know, he goes, "Hey, kid, can you catch?" And I said, "What a question, I can catch." And so he goes, "Okay, yeah, let me see." So during batting practice, he wanted me to catch in BP. And I go, "You're going to let me catch in batting practice? Come on. No, I just want to see if you can do it." Okay. So I caught, you know, for one hitter, I caught probably 10 or 12, just like a catcher. And I'd frame it, you know, and they threw a couple in the dirt and I blocked it. And so then I after the hitter was out, I walked out of the cage with my gear on. And I put my catcher's glove right in Joe Torre's gut. And I go, "Call me when you need me, Skip." You know, so I could have played all nine, but you know, you have to have a manager that would let that do that. So I ended up getting my time in the majors because I could play all the positions. I don't know how far I would have been in today's game with the metrics because my numbers weren't good. So I don't know how long I would have lasted, but you know, in that time, I brought more to the table than just playing. I was a clubhouse leader. I was an energy giver. You need that in a long game like baseball. So, I'd like to say that I could have been a wit, but I never could control the bat like that. Yeah. I couldn't hit like he could, but I could play anywhere. Yeah. And so when the time, I was mainly a second baseman though. And I remember playing for the Cardinals and Jose Oquendo was playing second base and he got hurt. And I'm thinking to myself, man, this is my chance to be an everyday player now. So Joe Torre went up and brought Luis Alicea, brought him up from the minors and let him play second base. And I went into Joe Torre's office. Of course, I knocked on his door. "Mr. Torre, can I come in?" "Yeah. Yeah. Hood, what do you want?" "Joe, I just want to know, I'm an everyday player. I played every day in the minors at second base and hit 300 and did my job and could do that. And I just thought maybe I might get an opportunity to be an everyday player for you." And he goes, "Sit down, kid." And I said, "Hey, Mr. Torre, if you'll get the media guide out and look where I played in Montreal Expos, I played almost a full season, and look at my numbers and just tell me, are those good enough to play for you?" And so he didn't have to get up and get the book out. But I just thought, you know, I just use that as an example. He got up out of his desk and went over and got the yearbook out, you know, the media guide book. And he looked and he goes, "Wow, you stole 29 bases in a half a season. You hit 280, 290 for the big leagues in Montreal. You could, look, there's no doubt that you could play every day for me, but you know what? You can do so many things for me. You can play every outfield position, every infield position. You know, you showed me you could catch if I needed you to. I don't have anybody like that. That's why I summoned another player. I couldn't find, there's not another player like you. So if you get tired of that, I'll talk to Dal Maxwell and we'll see if we can trade you. But I just want to let you know how valuable you're, my wild card in my poker hand. I need you." And you know what? I got up and said, "Mr. Torre, thank you so much. I appreciate that." So he had the ability to motivate. And Joe, he made me feel like I was a real special player. And so I want to take a bullet for him. You know, I want to please him. Every manager was like my daddy. It was like my father, you know? And so it made me feel so good that my dad loved me that way. And he told me how good I was that, "That's okay, Joe. All right. I'll be ready for you." And I walked out of his office. So, you know, I could bring a lot. I could pinch run in the ninth, if we needed to get, if it was a tie game. Later in my career, I could hit homers off the bench, pinch hit homers. So I became a commodity, and that's what allowed me to play in the game until I was 38 years old. And I got tired, and I told them, "I got to go home now."
Yeah.
So I was very, very proud to have walked away from a game that tells you when to walk away.
Now, one of the things that I think Royals fans have really come to love about you is your ability to joke about yourself. You joke a lot on the air about basically being a dumb jock. But recently, play-by-play man Ryan Lefevre told me on a podcast, and he did so on the air during a recent game, he reminded us that you were going to attend Notre Dame. That's not an easy school to get into. You have to be a pretty smart guy, don't you?
Well, you know what? I'd like to tell you, Dave, that I have good common sense. Okay. and largely because of the worldly degree. The worldly degree in baseball was amazing. It was challenging. It was difficult. It was humbling. All those things make you grow. And I talk about it on the broadcast, humble pie. Okay. Humble pie is a pie that's known in baseball that every player has to eat. Now some of them get one piece and some get the whole pie. Some get a bite, get a taste. And I was the guy who got the whole pie. And so when that happens, you know, and you're told no, and you're told you can't make it, and you're told other things, and you're 0-4, you're hitting 220, you know, you can't get a job next year. I mean, all those challenges and all those things help build your character. And do you have what it takes to finish? Can you continue to go? Can you keep your head up? How do you handle the adversity? So dealing with all those, and I call it a worldly degree, helped make me strong and helped me make who I am. I wouldn't change the 10 years in the minors for anything. That taught me how to persevere, how to not quit. If I want something bad enough, and the big leagues is worth pushing for.
Yeah,
it is worth it. Even at 28 years old, after I looked back and I went, wow, I got a couple of cups of coffee in the majors and getting married. And I'm getting ready to marry a nice girl who would like nice things. And I looked in my bank account and I had enough money for a couple months rent. And I was going, man, you're going to ask this girl to marry you and you don't have anything. All right. So that added another log on the fire. Whit Merrifield calls it a chip on his shoulder. I had a log in my heart. Whit did some minor league time, and he didn't do the time I did.
Right.
So I threw another log on that fire, and an internal fire that was burning, and I couldn't wait to get my shot. And when I did, I told my wife, honey, I'm going to get 10 years in the big leagues with God's help and your help. And I was right. She blessed my life. Never went back to the minors. But I really enjoyed each moment. The 10 years of minor league, it made me enjoy every day being a big leaguer, Dave. When I went to the ballpark, we might have been in last place. Might have been hitting 210. But you know what? I learned how to walk into a clubhouse when people are watching you with my chest up and my shoulders back and my head up, looking at people, speaking, hi, how you doing, sir? How are you? Hey, how's it going today? And pretending that we're in first place and I'm hitting 300.
Yeah.
That's how I carried myself. That's how I handled the toughness of the game, the failure part of it, by a positive mental outlook, by physical body language, the language that tells people when you're not speaking how you're going. And so that really helped me how to carry myself when things were bad. And I end up playing on a lot of bad teams. And I found out in professional sports, when you lose, jobs are threatened. Managers are threatened their jobs. Coaches are threatened. So it's not always the best place to be, but God used me to be light in a dark place. And I went in there and I didn't care. I had the right etiquette and I used my manners. But I walked in like I owned the house and with a smile on my face and let the guys know, hey, we got a game today, man. Who's going to help? Who's going to drive the bus? You know, every day. So I think God used me in those losing environments to bring light, man, to bring light and encouragement to those who didn't have it.
Where did the nickname Rex the Wonder Dog come from?
I'm so thankful that I was able to make it to the big leagues, to be on highlight tapes and to make diving catches a few times, you know, and I was on a couple plays of the week and whatever. And Chris Berman, the wonderful ESPN broadcaster one day goes, "Wow, what a catch he made. That's Rex the Wonder Dog." You know, because Rex was the name that they used for a dog in the 50s and 60s in the textbooks in school. Okay. I think then it went on to Spot, you know, see Spot Run, but it was Rex before that. So in that generation, that's how they knew me. That was a dog's name. So that's how the name came. But I had gotten other nicknames when I played for the Cardinals, because thankfully for the great Mike Shannon and Jack Buck, you know, I'd slide into second base and Shannon would go, "Wow, he stirred up so much dirt. He looks like a hurricane." You know, so they called me Hurricane Huddler. Jack nicknamed me Head First Huddler because I always went head first and I was flying all over the place. And so, you know, just a huge blessing for other people to give you nicknames.
I remember when you first came to Kansas City with the Royals, and 2012, I think, was your first year, right?
That's right.
And it was probably 2 or 3 weeks in, and you were just getting ripped up and down by the fans, by the media, because you were so different than Frank White. And I remember I wanted to say, we passed in the tunnel between the where the media went towards the dugout, and you were talking to Monty, Jeff Montgomery, and Joel Goldberg was there, and we talked about the fact of you having to fill big shoes with Frank. And he said, "You know, I never had to do that. The Royals never had a sideline reporter, you know, in that role, but it's so hard." And I said, "What people need to understand is Rex isn't putting on a show. He's not trying to do something. He's just being him. I remember Rex Huddler, the player." And I said, "What you guys need to do when you're talking about him is show clips of Rex diving into third base or bowing to Randy Johnson or whatever those highlights are, and let people know that the Rex that they're seeing on TV is just Rex. That's just him." And I think it, I don't know if he was planning on doing that anyway, but they started showing some of those highlights and people started saying, "He's not putting on an act. He's just being himself." Just talk about where your enthusiasm comes from.
You know, thank you. I love my partners, Monty and Goldie. I love them so much, like brothers. We stay in touch in the off season. You know, it's so fun to be able to work with people you like and enjoy, you know. And Ryan and I have gotten to become brothers. He's my younger brother, my little brother. But I have so much respect for him and his professionalism and how he had it in his genes to be a ball player, but he played like 1 month of A ball and went, "Oh man, I can't see this. I can't see me sticking this out, and I'm going to do something else." I commend him greatly for that. Yeah. Because had I not become a big leaguer, I would have wasted 10 of my most precious years of pushing to baseball. But anyway, he got out, he became a professional, a Steve Fiziok, or is a real pro, K-State guy. He became a broadcaster because he wanted to, and he loves sports, and these guys have been able to do it. But I can just tell you that enthusiasm, the first part of that, enthuo, is Greek for of God. Enthusiasm is enthuo of God. That's who I was. I was made for that. My great grandpa was the greatest man I ever knew. My grandma on my dad's side was the greatest woman I ever knew. So I had great lineage ahead of me. They were people of God, and they had character. They were characters. And I remember watching my great granddaddy. You know, and he was just he laughed all the time. You know, he taught me how to milk a cow. There's so many things as a young person that I gathered. My mom taught me how to say yes, sir, yes, ma'am, no, ma'am. She taught me manners, which is something that a lot of young people aren't taught anymore. So I had a character about me, and I had I was a live wire, and I had energy. So I was raised by a tough woman, a strong woman, which was amazing for me. I'm so thankful. I miss her. She's been gone for several years now, but she was my hero. And that's the way it should be. Your parents should be a big part of your life. But, you know, she taught me a lot. She was tough on me and my two brothers. She, you know, if we stepped out of line, if we If she called my name and I answered, huh? Boy, watch out, because here come the right hand, man. It was coming. I had to duck. Don't huh me. You say, excuse me or ma'am. You know, so we were polished. And so to go along with my athleticism and the coaching that taught me the importance of hustling and being a good teammate. And I was ready. When I went to play pro ball, I was ready and I held my own. So my mother and my family, my upbringing is where the character came from. And then I always hustled everywhere I went. I would pick up my bag and I would run to the next station. I never walked anywhere because I was taught that when you hustle and run, people are attracted by that. They watch that. If you walk, you don't get any attention. So I was almost a lot too much for my teammates. They were like, man, hey, you're showing me up, man. What are you doing? You know, so that's just kind of who I was. And that was all from my upbringing. And so that helped mold me to endure a 21-year pro career.
You're a people person, obviously. How difficult was it for you to not accept criticism, because it wasn't criticism of you? You were just different. How hard was it for you to be unpopular? And just talk about the transition to now, you're one of the most popular people in Kansas City.
Oh, Dave, thank you. I'm over HUD anyway. I don't make that big a deal about me. But look, when Kevin Ulick, vice president of the Kansas City Royals, called me in California and offered me the job, and I love him so much. He helped me. He gave me a job in Anaheim with the Angels for my first 11 years broadcasting there too. So he said, it's going to be very difficult in the beginning. It's going to be hard. You need to prepare yourself. And actually I tried to talk him out of it. I was like, what? You got 30 ex-players that live there. How come you're not offering them the position? Why are you asking me? And so I was kind of had to make sure I was checking things right. And he said, we needed two things. We wanted experience. You have experience. And you know, our owner, Mr. Glass, watched you play for the Cardinals. He's a Cardinal fan. He loved your play. And then when our games were over in the Midwest here, we would tune into your broadcast in Anaheim. He liked you. He wanted your positive energy. So that's why we're offering you the job. You have two things that none of those other players have. He goes, but it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard because people in the Midwest, they're very protective of their roles, of their important positions. And those folks, they're not going to take kindly to you, especially after coming after one of our icon players. So be prepared. And so, okay, sure, no problem. I handled a baseball career that I wasn't very good, and people yelled at me all the time. I could handle that. But I had no idea that I was going to be raked over the coals here. And that when I put my head on my pillow at night after the first month of the season, I could hear arrows being shot at me, Dave. Shoo, shoo, shoo. And I'm going, what the heck is that? And, you know, I'd wake up and I would hear, literally hear, and that was the internet. That was all the negative talk about me. And I couldn't help it but feel that. And so I'm like, well, keep your head down. And so, you know, I had asked God if he would give me another job in broadcasting when the Angels let me go. And you know, heck, 29 teams and there's only 29 other teams. I mean, that's 29 jobs in the country. And so I'm thinking, man, you know what? That sounds like a hard and tough odds to get that. But you know what? My God, he doesn't believe in odds. He answered that in a heartbeat, and he had the Royals call me out of nowhere. I never played for the Royals. I mean, typically a color commentating spot is for somebody that played for your organization and the people know. So it was a very unusual way. But, you know, when I heard and I felt all that, I woke up that morning after hearing all those arrows being shot over my head. And I asked God, are you sure? Man, you know, because this is kind of rough. And I probably shouldn't have questioned God, and it's okay to question him, but I probably shouldn't have, because he yelled at me and he said, you get out of bed and you go to that ballpark and you be the guy I called you to be. I open this door for you. When I open doors, I don't crack doors. I don't crack them with this little crack of light. I fling them wide open. You go. I called you for that. And you go there and you go early and you pass out your baseball cards that I allowed that career for you. And you tell those fans that you're the new color guy. And hey, I hope you enjoy the game today at Kauffman Stadium. You know, so I went, man, I stood right up and went, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I can do that. Okay. Yeah. So I went. I went to the K. And, you know, that season in 12, we lost our first 10 home games of the season. The first 10-game homestand, we lost every game. And I, during my baseball playing career, during my broadcasting career for the Angels, we never lost a 10-game homestand. You're going to win one of those by accident. So I remember the fans were all turning around. They were looking up in the booth. They had signs that they were making, where's Frank? We miss Frank. There was airplanes flying over Kauffman Stadium that said, where's Frank? You know, we want Frank. I mean, it was something like I'd never been through before. But, you know, the Royals and Kevin Hulick called me at the All-Star break and after the great All-Star game we had there in Kansas City. And he said, where's the broadcast? Yeah, there it is. You got it on. Where's the broadcaster we hired? Because, you know, we were losing and, you know, I couldn't be. I said, Mr. Hulick, your crowd can only take a half a dose of HUD right now. They can't take a full dose of me. If I gave them a full dose, they'd really be upset. So let's wait for them to start playing better. They're going to win in the second half. Sure enough, they started playing better in the second half. And I was able to become more comfortable and be myself. And then the next year. I went home in 2012, the last game of the season. Mr. David Glass came on the broadcast, and he was kind of reclusive when it came to the media. Okay. He came on the broadcast to tell the fans that it was time that he gave Dayton some resources, that this team was we're going to win. And I remember looking at the great Mike Swanson, the media relations director at the booth, in the door of the booth before he came in, and Swanee was shaking. He was so nervous, and I'm going, man, what's wrong? Well, what's going on? Well, he was just nervous because the boss, the owner, has never been on before, and he was a little worried.
Yeah.
And so then when Mr. Glass got on the air and said that I come to every game, in the meantime, nobody thought he ever came. They just thought he stayed in Arkansas and counted his money. You know, you remember how that was, Dave.
Yeah.
And so he talked about all of his players and A-ball, double-A, triple-A. He named all of them. He sounded just like he was a fan, and he was, and he watched his team. And so I remember getting in the car, leaving, the season's over, and I'm driving to the airport to go fly back to California, and I heard so much on 810 and 610, our area sports shows, was positive. They were all, did you hear Mr. Glass? Did you hear him? He's going to supply Dayton. And I'd never been on a team or a part of a team that lost 98 games that had so much optimism the day after the season was over. Yeah. So when I got on the airplane, I flew home. Jennifer met me at the airport. I said, she goes, honey, how was it? Honey, I told her back, they're going to win there. I feel God's calling us all there. We need to move. We need to be there and experience it. They're going to win. Oh, and by the way, in 12, when I joined the team, it was in Dayton Moore's office, and Mr. Moore said, hey, I don't know, when I asked him, hey, what do you think? When do you think this team might have the possibility to win? He says, well, you know, we're hoping that possibly by 2014, they'll win. How about that? Okay, so Dave, 13, they're 10 games over 500. Now we're bringing good news to the Royals fans, me and Ryan and Fizz, and the fans are kind of going, you know what? He's kind of growing on me, this broadcaster. He's kind of growing on me. You know, I think I like him, you know, for now. So winning, when you hear the term winning cures all, that's what it does.
Yeah.
It cures all, not some. It cures all. That's including the redheaded broadcaster that no one liked. So I'm so thankful that the Dayton Moore and his timing of his people, his team, and they won, and the people started embracing me a little more, understanding who I was. And, you know, Dave, I'm an acquired taste. Man, I'm not like other people. And I would rub a lot of people wrong because they couldn't handle me. My teammates would, like, you know, we would be like, HUD, be quiet. We can't. That's enough. You know, so I totally understand how the crowd is, but man, we couldn't have come to a better team in a better city in America or anywhere in the world for that matter. Jennifer and I and my four kids, we benefited greatly from it, and we're continuing to smell the roses, and we're going to win again, Dave. I can't wait, because the winning and experiencing that here in Kansas City was amazing. The fans and how they rocked it, and the K was rocking. And I'm getting goosebumps right now just thinking about that. I can't wait for it to happen.
Right, I want to ask you what Ryan calls HUDisms. So I want to ask you the origins of some of these things. The first one is the one my wife watches the games with me when they're on the road, but I'm not at the stadium. And when somebody strikes out, sometimes she'll beat you to the punch. She'll say, "You got to go." Where did that one come from?
I never ever intended or anything for anybody to use the term HUDisms. What are you talking about? I just do the game, and my job is to educate fans, and I educate fans on baseball terminology, at least in my day. And then I try to spend enough time with the modern day players that I can pick up some of their lingo too.
Right.
And so we want to share that with the people. And Jackie Moore was a third base coach for the Montreal Expos, a manager for the Oakland A's, had a great baseball career himself. Really a respectful man. I loved him. And he would, I'd be in the dugout and somebody would strike out and he would say, "You got to go," you know, and that just kind of stuck with me. And then this was years before I went in the broadcast booth. And then one day with the Angels, a guy got the other team. I don't use it on our side at all. I don't use it on our guys. Right. And I only use it usually on a call third strike. It just came out, "You got to go." And so, you know, that was just kind of, you know, some kind of just to have fun and a flair, not to rub it in on the opponent, you know, right, but just to have a good time. "Hey, you got to go." And that's what the umpire is saying. You know, "You're out."
Yeah.
And it just kind of happened. And a lot of things happen. And, you know, it's a live broadcast. So some things that come out of my mouth, I'd like to grab and bring back, you know, oops.
I'm not going to bring up today. There's a couple of others that I will, but one, you know, I'm talking about, I'm not going to bring up because it's politically insensitive. But anyway, the next one I want to talk about is the origin of drive the bus. Is that from something sitting in the dugout?
Yeah, that's in the clubhouse. That starts early. That would start early. We'd be in there, you know, after the media's out, you know, media comes in for 30, 40 minutes, whatever. The media leaves. We'd come in after infield practice, and now there's a 20 minutes before the game. We're sitting in there, and everybody's kind of getting prepared, a little bit mentally, you know, prepared. Lots of times, you know, if I didn't say it, maybe somebody else would. "Fellas, who's driving today? Who's driving the bus?" You know, and this is just, and everybody look around at each other at the locker room, you know, and when you stuck your hand up, that put pressure on you.
Yeah.
You had to do something that game. If you said, I'm driving, yeah, okay, all aboard, jump on, man, let's go." So we would do that all the time, man. "Who's driving? Who's driving the bus?" And then I brought that up to the broadcast booth. Same thing, man. "Who's driving?" Yeah. "Somebody's got to be driving today." And so that kind of was fun for the fans. The fans can get on that too. And I know I know all aboard, that's for a train. But I don't care. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
I use it for the bus. "Hey, let's go. Who's on? Who's driving?" And some guys don't have the license to drive. Okay. Some guys, they can't do it. I mean, they don't have the skill to drive the bus. They can't make a game winning catch or a hit or make a pitch. So they wouldn't raise their hand. And, you know, I would raise my hand all the time, because even though I may not be the best to drive the bus, I want my chance to drive the bus.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then sometimes you'd come through. But that's just a fun thing. It's a rallying tool.
The last one I want to ask you about is, you can't sneak a piece of cheese by a hungry rat.
That's right. Cheese, referring to a fastball in baseball. That's what they call fastball. Cheese.
Cheese
at the knees. Right. There's all okay. So you know, that just came out. You know, you can't sneak a piece of cheese by a hungry rat, because the rat, that's what he feeds on. He loves cheese, you know, and he's not going to miss any cheese. So that just came out. And then, you know, then I thought for a while the player might think I'm calling him a rat, but that wasn't it either. So there are sometimes I'll say, you can't sneak a piece of cheese by a hungry Salvi, you know, or something like that. I'll right. make it a little more personal, but, and that just comes out. That comes out because I'm excited. Like in yesterday's game against the White Sox, Lance Lynn's complete game, and it was an incredible performance by him, you know, and he throws 86% fastballs.
Yeah.
And so when I'm on the pregame or when we're doing our open, and I'm saying, come on, fellas, pick out a piece of cheese and ride this guy, man. You know, and so no one could pick out any cheese on him. Yeah. His cheese was moving. He had velvet cheese, man. His cheese was pretty special. You know, you couldn't touch it. So you know, that's I get wrapped up in the game. And as a color commentator, I come to the ballpark with my mindset as a player, and I'm facing this guy tonight. So my job is to tell the fans what to look for from this pitcher. I'm going to face him. This is what I'm looking for. So I want to bring the fans into the game. I try to bring them a real color commentator, and I have character. I'm a lot like Dizzy Dean back in the day. Dizzy Dean was a real character. Yeah. You know, I had a fan say that he kind of, I reminded him of Harry Carey. And I went, what? Thank you, sir. That's a great compliment to him. But you know, like I said, a preferred taste, but you know, I love baseball. What people are hearing is real, man. I show up and I've learned Ryan's helped me a lot. You know, he's helped me so much. I've learned from him. But I used to be so jacked at the first inning and before the game. My producer has a term, spray bottle, HUD spray bottle. And that means to calm down. That's, you know, when you spray a bottle, a dog, you know, when he's barking or something,
yeah.
You know, you just spray him. And he would just mention it to me. He'd HUD, do we need a spray bottle today? Because I'd be so worked up, you know? So that's just how I am, Dave. But I've learned how to tone it down and bring it out whenever it's necessary.
All right. I've got to ask you about one other one, and it's not the one you're thinking of, but my all-time favorite HUD call. It was either Pittsburgh or Cincinnati. The Royals are playing. Some guy down the left field line decides to try and catch a high pop-up in the end of the stands. He was a bald guy, and it missed his hands, hit off the top of his head, and bounced away. And you say, oh, the poor fella took it off the dome. And then the security people come down, and I guess they had a card system. If the person's fine, they'd hold up a green card. If there's a little bit of injury and they need to be, you know, dealt with or taken care of, they get, you know, they hold up a yellow card. And if hey, hurry up down here with medics, they get a red card. So after you say, you know, the poor fella took it off the dome, and he got a yellow card for it.
You know,
I replayed that scene like four times and laughed harder every time.
Hey, was that Uncle Fester?
Yes, it was.
Yeah. So the team's just in Cleveland, and that I think it was in Cleveland where that happened. Last night or yesterday, not yesterday, but a couple of days ago when the team was in Cleveland, I asked Ryan in the broadcast, isn't this where Uncle Fester lives? Didn't he live here? Anyway, but you know, we missed the fans so much last year because they're such a big part of the game. But we like to banter. We have fun with fans. And our director, Steve Kurtenbach, he pans the stands for stuff. And it gives them something to talk about, a little diversion other than the game. And so we're so happy they're back, Dave. And if you remember a shot like that, then maybe there's a chance somebody else did. And that's what it's all about, yeah. Man. Memories. What can we do for others?
How quickly do you think, or how soon do you think you guys will be able to travel with the team on the road? Do you know yet when that's going to happen?
No, but I can tell you, my wife, Jennifer, can't wait. First year in our 32 years of marriage, that we've been together for 18 months straight. And Dave, I can tell you, I know now why I married her. I'm in love with her more now than ever. I mean, so, but honestly, she kind of likes to have the house to herself for a 6-day, 7-day road trip. But I'm looking forward to that, because that way we can be better broadcasters for our fans. I can talk to anybody I want to down there in the clubhouse or in the field, you know, if they made an impact on the game the night before, and tell our fans what he was thinking, what he was doing. There's a lot to that, because our fans here in Kansas City are the greatest fans in the world. We have we're always in the top five of 30 teams in ratings, because all of our crowd, our fans here watch the game. Yeah. They're loyal. And so they deserve for us to go on the road. I hope it happens.
Yeah. I've got two finishing questions. The next to last one may take us another hour. So I ask it with some trepidation. What's the best part of your job?
Wow, man. We don't have enough time, but I will tell you the best part of my job to me is seeing baseball fans every day, going to the ballpark every day, leaving my problems in the car, in the parking lot at the K, getting out and just being HUD, just having fun with the people, looking for somebody to engage, looking for somebody to talk about baseball with, and going through saying hi to people. You know, I can't stand the way the mask has taken the smile away. We've learned so much during this pandemic, and I've learned, one of the biggest things I've learned was how much I miss a smile. I miss what you have to give to somebody else. And then get up to the broadcast booth and have the privilege of talking about a baseball team on television.
Yeah.
And, you know, that to me is a great privilege here, to have the only job, me and Monty in Kansas City, being an analyst for a big league city and a big league team. And then being prepared in my life to engage people in the off season and living in the city. When I was a player, we bought a house in every city we lived in, because we wanted to engage in the community. We wanted to be involved. We want to be givers and not takers. And we want to love on people. And so that being a broadcaster allows me to do that. And, you know, I can tell you, even back in my playing days, Jennifer and I would have an argument at home. And we would always try to settle the argument before I went to work, you know. But there were times when I left the door slammed or whatever. You know, there were times when I was still angry, and I would get to the ballpark and man, I would feel bad for what I said. And I would go to the phone, the wall phone. We didn't have cell phones.
Right.
I'd go to the wall phone, and I'd call Jennifer, and I'd say, honey, I'm so sorry, you know, that I said those things. You know, I didn't mean it. She goes, oh, you must be at the ballpark. so she knew that whenever I got near the ballpark or inside the ballpark, that transformed me. And I'm so thankful that God allowed me to live the desires and the dreams of my heart and to live it every day. That's why I'm so happy every day. I mean, I can't help it. I just want to share that love of the game, and loving people too is what my God commands. So that's easy to do. Even, you know what? You don't have to like me, Dave, but you can't stop me from liking you.
Yeah. You know, well, I do like you, but thank you.
Yeah. You don't have to. People don't have to like me.
Yeah.
You know, and I know I didn't make friends when I was a player either. And because I was really a dangerous player between the lines, I was paid to win and I played hard. So, you know, guys looked at me, you know, kind of really. Yeah. So, but off the field, I'm a lover, and I sure do. Enjoy the question that you asked me there, because it's the blessing being a broadcaster.
All right, last question, then I will give you a chance to give a statement. Last question, and I know the answer to this, but I want to give you the opportunity. You always have a ball in your hands during the broadcast. Just talk about why you're doing that. I see in pregame, you're tossing a ball up in the air, and you always are, you know, rolling them like you're a pitcher preparing to find the perfect seam. Why do you always have a ball in your hands?
Yeah, you know, Dave, I can tell you as I'm reaching for mine now, I can't find it here. But you know, Dave, when I was a player and I rode the pine for nine, you know, some long games, you know, there were always steps in there, you know, and I would throw the ball against the steps and it would bounce back to me, and I would throw it against the step, and if you didn't throw it right, it would bounce onto the field. So you had to throw it just right, so it would skip right there, in the middle of it, and it would come right back to me. And I would do those things, of course, at the end of the bench. And I didn't distract anyone. It got on some people's nerves, but it just was a natural transition to me. I went right from the field after the 98 season in 99. I was a Philadelphia Philly in 98, and then I went to the booth in Anaheim in 99, and it just felt like a natural progression. So, and then as I, it was kind of a pacifier, like a baby pacifier for me, help calm my nerves a little bit. But then I realized that sometimes people in a bar or maybe having a cold drink or a beer or maybe watching the game, but there's no sound, but if they see me, I'm marketing the game of baseball. So they know what sport we're talking about. So it markets the game. Number one, it's a pacifier for me. Number two, it markets the game. And number three, it's so fun to give a baseball away to a kid in the parking lot on the way out after the game. And so I started doing that with the Angels, and I went to Mr. Autry, Gene Autry, who was the owner of the Angels. And I said, a cowboy, you have to charge me for about three or four dozen baseballs. Cause I usually take a batting practice ball and I'll give it away after the game. And I do that because I want to market the game. And look, I know it's, maybe it might be out of bounds. And he and Mr. Glass, when I said that to them, they laughed and said, "Oh, kid, don't worry about writing me a check for that. You're marketing baseball, and that's exactly what we want." So that's why I carry the ball, is to market the game mainly, and then to give it away. And it's a dad will be walking with a son or a daughter or a little baby, and I'll go out, walk out, and I'll say, "Hey, did you guys get a game ball today?" And they'll say, "No, we didn't get one." "Hey, how about this one? I got it." I reach into my bag, and I give it to him. And you'd have thought I gave him a 5-carat diamond. So to me, it is so worth it and so precious to be able to give a baseball to somebody and to see their smile. It's priceless.
I will tell you, and I wondered if you were going to bring this up. I think when we talked about the transition when you went from being the villain to being the real likable guy that everybody liked. I don't know that it was exactly this, but I remember something fairly early in your broadcasting career. And I don't even remember if it was a home game or a road game, but I know I was not at the stadium. I was watching on TV, and there was a foul ball. And I don't remember all the details. You probably do, but a little kid started crying because he didn't get a baseball, and left.
I'll pick the story up for you, Dave.
Okay.
The kid down the line got the ball, and he was so excited about the baseball, and his mom stood up and started talking to the kid, and they still were on camera, and she's talking to the kid, and what she was telling him was, "Hey, your cousin Johnny, we just brought him. He's never been to a game before. Why don't you give him the ball?" And so you could see it. You could see the mom talking to the kid, pleading with the kid. And then you could see the kid, his head went down. And then he begrudgingly gave the cousin the ball. Okay. He gave him the ball. We're watching this. And I'm going, "Oh, mom, come on, man. You can't ask him to do that." And so I pushed the button and talked to my producer in the truck. And I said, "Hey, can I go give that kid my baseball?" Just like that. And he goes, "Yeah, Hud, go ahead." Which is like, they don't want me. They don't want me to do that anymore for whatever reasons. But I put my headset down and I went down there, and of course they filmed it all. And I told the kid, "Hey, it's okay, man. Here, you can have my ball." And I just gave it to him. I wasn't trying to make a big look at what I could do. And
were being Hud.
Exactly. I was loving on the kid. I felt bad for him that he gave the ball to the cousin, the other kid. And his mom made him do it. So I'll never forget that either. That was so fun to be able to do that. I wish they'd let me go in the crowd more often, but they kind of poo-pooed that.
Yeah. But for whatever reason. My point with that, Hud, is that it probably started already, but that's when people said, "This guy is pretty cool. This guy gets it." And I think that's when you became lovable, and that's when you became beloved in Kansas City.
Well, you're using some strong words there, Dave, and I appreciate that. But, still, I don't, when you're in a position like that and thousands of people are listening to every word that you say during the course of a broadcast, it can be intimidating. My purpose is really not to gain followers and to be likable. Sure, everyone wants to be liked. My job is to make the broadcast good. I try to learn how to bring. I have so many stories of living in three countries, living in every time zone in America, playing ball in three countries. 10 in the minors, 10 in the majors. There's so many stories there. So instead of saying I did this, and well, you know what I did, I'm learned how to say this is what a player goes through right. when he's on to try to to keep me out of it. And it's hard. It doesn't always happen, but I want to educate the people. I care about the broadcast. I care about, doing my part and let my partner breathe and let him do his thing and let him set me up. And so I'm really into that. But I do appreciate the people that understand me and they speak HUD now. And it's really fun. Yeah.
It's a good way of putting it. People who speak HUD, and my wife is one of them. She hasn't told me yet, when I'm getting on her nerves, you got to go, but I'm guessing that's coming soon. Okay. I want to wrap up with this. I like to let people, especially people like you that I know, this is a priority. Tell about your family, your beautiful wife, Jennifer, and your kids.
Oh, Dave, thank you. I think I shared, I prayed for a wife after 10 years of minor league baseball. I wandered, I chased, I ran, I did all the stuff that people think is cool in baseball to be a baseball player. And it was really tiring. And it was, I was afraid of the future. Being adopted at 8 years old myself, I didn't want to put my children through a divorce or anything like that. So I was afraid of my choice for a wife, but I was wanting a wife. I wanted to settle down in the worst way. And so I put the pressure on God. I said, God, can you please help me find a wife? And it's interesting. His response, he went, "Oh, HUD. Nice to hear from you, buddy. I want you to know while you've been running around doing all that stuff that you've been doing, I've been here the whole time. You're the one who walked away. Okay. But yeah, look, I made the mountains. I can find you a wife. Okay. And so he lifted Jennifer up. And this has not just happened like for a week. I prayed for months and maybe a year. And he lifted Jennifer up, and I had, girlfriends in different parts of the country. Cause I played ball all over, you meet people and he lifted her up and I go, "Wow, God, you have great taste, man. She's beautiful." And you know what? And she is also beautiful on the inside. And God goes, "Hey, you asked me and you've been praying to me to help you find a wife. That there she is. Now it's up to you to catch her. You got to catch her. I'm out of that." And so I said, "Okay." And I went after, I pursued her. And I remember I was with the Baltimore Orioles. I was 28 years old and I was in Miami, Florida. And I'm my locker mates, Cal Ripken Jr., Eddie Murray, Freddie Lynn, some guys are around. And I came in one day and I said, Hey guys, I'm getting ready to propose to my future wife. Any ideas? I mean, I gotta make this special. Cause when I met her and she found out I was a ball player, she didn't want anything to do with me. So, you couldn't blame her. A 10-year minor leaguer got no money. Who wants to marry a guy like that? It's wasted all their time doing nothing, So anyway, Cal Ripken goes, "HUD, go to Key Biscayne. It's 20-minute drive here. Take her out in the ocean, in the bay here. Take her around, rent a tall ship. Rent her, go around sunset. Bring a bottle of champagne. Do it up, man. And then if she says no, throw her overboard." So, all the guys laughed. That was clubhouse banter. And he was just throwing it out there.
Yeah.
It was a great idea. I got in my car and I went down there and I searched for a tall ship. And there it was, Spirit of Miami, big 40-foot sailboat, beautiful, old fashioned. I went to the guy and said to the captain, "Hey, sir, do you rent this boat? Can I rent it?" "Yeah, you can rent it." Got the date when she came and everything. She had no idea. I told her we were going to go out for a sightseeing tour. And I bought a ring that I could afford. A nice engagement ring. But then I started thinking, she may not like this one. I better get a bigger one. So I had to take out a loan to get a bigger one, like two or three carats, whatever it was. It was big. And I took two rings and I had them in my pockets and just in case. So I we get on the boat She's like, wow, this is beautiful. We get out there where the sun's going down. And she had no idea what was going to happen. So I took her to the front of the boat. I got on my knee and I go, you're the woman that God's chosen for me. And I want you to be my wife. And I want to take care of you. All the things you say when you propose. And I pulled out the ring and I showed it to her and she didn't say anything. And I was like, oh man, I can't throw her overboard. So cold sweat started coming down my face. And I was like, oh, hey, if you don't like that one, how about this one? And I reached in my pocket and I pulled out the other one and I showed her the other one that was bling, you know, and she looked at it. She laughed and she goes, all right, I'll marry you, but not for another year. You know, because, you know, she was like shocked that I would, propose to her and everything. And so I was like, that's a yes, yes. And so we redid our vows when we got married. And I told God, hey, God, you know what? I sure do appreciate you helping me find her. And he goes, you know what, I'm going to let you in the promised land now. The reason I didn't let you be a big leader is because you were running your life for you. And I'm not going to bless that. So look, now that you remember me and you called on my name, I'm going to let you in, but you're going to play on every last place team that I can find. You're not going to be you're not going to play in one championship team. You're not going to play in one postseason game. And you know, Dave, I told him, hey, God, thanks. I just want to be a big leaguer. I've worked so hard. Thank you, God. And so he let me in. I played on 4, 5, 6 different teams, and he was right. I never played on one postseason game, not one. But he wanted to use me and my spirit in these clubhouses. And so Mary and Jennifer, I never went back to the minors. She got me nothing but 10 years in the major league. So she supported me. She loved me. And then we got it. And I took her everywhere we went for 7 years before we started having kids because I wanted to bond our relationship. I wanted her to share the big leagues with her and let her see what that was like. Let her see what it was like. And so we could have fun in these cities and go out in Chicago and New York and San Francisco. And so I took her everywhere. And then we looked at the clock and went, man, we better start having some family here. We're mid-30s, man. We got to go. Oh, okay. It's almost like we were having so much fun. We forgot. And then here we come. And I prayed for a daughter because nothing but boys have been in our life and in our family. And so what does he give me? He gives me a little girl, the first kid I had, the first girl in the family. And, man, I never forget that, Dave. It was a special moment. And then, you know, I always talk to my kids when they were in the womb. And I would talk to them all the time. And so they knew my voice. And when she came out, she was crying. And I went over to that hot pad, you know, or whatever they put the babies on. And I whispered, hey, it's your daddy. And I remember she was wailing, crying, and she stopped. She stopped and she listened for my voice. And when she did, Dave, it was the greatest thing I ever experienced as a dad. That right then she by her stopping crying and listening for me, told me that she's counting on me to help her in her life. And so then we had others, and we had my next son, my firstborn son was going to be named after my great grandpa. I told you, it was the greatest man I ever knew, Cade, you know? And so Cade was born, and Cade was born a little differently. He had an extra chromosome. So they call that in the world Down syndrome. But what we've learned to know that Cade has Up syndrome. He don't have Down syndrome.
Yeah.
He got nothing but life for others. And he's been a blessing to us. And then we had two more boys after that, because we wanted to have some boys to carry, catch him developmentally and help pull him along. So you know, my legacy has been my kids and my family. They've meant so much to me. And even though I miss a lot of their summer activities during baseball season, I'd let Jennifer sleep in the winter. I do all the things. I clean the house. I go grocery shopping. I cook. Honey, you take it easy now. So that kind of partnership has worked over the last 32 years. And so we're really grateful for children in our life and that have taught us so much and how difficult it is. The hardest thing I've ever tried to do in my life, Dave, was to be a good father.
And it's probably the most rewarding too.
Yeah, no doubt. Hey, thank you so much for letting me share my life with you. And whoever would listen, on a day off from the K, but I'm at the ball field watching my son.
Well, I don't know how we've been talking for more than an hour, and I've absolutely loved it. It's always fun to chat with you, but to just get to do it one-on-one without anybody else coming in and wanting to butt into the conversation, that's been a pleasure. So I do appreciate you joining me, and I hope you have a great day, and I hope William wins his game.
Yeah, buddy. Hey, it's all about the journey and having so much fun, Dave, and sharing with the people. I can't wait to go Royals.
Thanks for listening to Sports Connections with David Smale. Make sure to subscribe, follow, and rate the show from your favorite podcast platform. You can learn more about David Smale and his work by visiting davidsmalebooks.com. Don't forget to join us weekly for new episodes. Until next time.